We've been going downhill for 5.5 years under the present economic policy that we have right up to this minute.
As long as everyone in the United States expects a wage increase every year, I don't see how you're ever going to stop inflation.
The word has to be discipline, discipline, discipline.
Currently, the industrial world is in a slump.
The mortgage situation is terrible.
It's a vicious circle, really.
We're doing something wrong.
Second Sunday, The Wayward Economy. From New York, Chicago, and Washington, a comprehensive review of the world and national economic situation. A look at the problems of recession and inflation, what's happening now, and what we can expect in the days ahead. This edition of Second Sunday is condensed from a 2-hour live discussion of the economy, broadcast over many of these stations in September. Now from New York, NBC News correspondent Edwin Newman.
Economics is an inexact science. If it weren't, we'd have fewer problems with the economy and we'd have greater unanimity about what to do about the problems that do arise. At present, there's even disagreement over the extent of our problems. Some say we're in the midst of a recession, others say no. The British weekly, The Economist, predicts that the years 1974 to 76 probably will be remembered as years of depression. President Ford has summoned economists and other interested parties to attend a series of meetings culminating in what has been billed as a summit conference to begin on September 27th. The aim is to determine the nature of our financial situation, to find ways of dealing with it, maybe even new ways, and to decide what areas of the country and the economy are especially hard hit and need help at once. Well, these are all questions we intend to explore during this special live program. Taking part with us in three cities are, first in New York, Peter Peterson, Secretary of Commerce under President Nixon and now Chairman of the Board of the investment banking firm of Lehman Brothers. Pierre Rinfrey, an economist and president of Rinfrey Boston Associates, an international financial counseling firm. Dr. Rinfrey is a former special economic advisor to the White House. Tilford Gaines, senior vice president and economist of Manufacturers Hanover Trust, formerly with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Michael Harrington, former chairman of the Socialist Party of the United States and author of, among other books, The Other America. Harry Brown, author of You Can Profit from a Monetary Crisis, and the writer known as Adam Smith. Adam Smith has written books and articles about the stock market and financial matters, the latest of his books being Super Money. Standing by in Washington with a number of participants is NBC News correspondent Peter Hackis.
Yes, Ed, good evening. Seated around our table here in Washington, Ralph Nader, one of the nation's leading consumer advocates, prime mover in several campaigns to protect citizens from government, business, and economic abuses. Democratic Congressman Wright Patman of Texas, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee and alternate chairman of the Joint Senate-House Economic Committee. Alice Rivlin is an economist at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Dr. Rivlin has served as an assistant secretary of health, education, and welfare and has concentrated, among other areas, on the economics of national priorities. Stanley Rutenberg, who has served as economic advisor and assistant secretary in the Labor Department. Earlier, he spent many years as a top official in the labor movement. Democratic Congressman Henry Royce of Wisconsin, a 9-term member of Congress, a member of both the House Banking and Currency Committee and the Joint Senate-House Economic Committee. We're ready if you are, Ed.
Thank you, Peter. We have three participants in Chicago, and to introduce them, Bill Cameron.
From Chicago, we have a panel calculated to gauge the threat particularly posed by rising food prices and to interpret the general effect of the inflation on the entire economy. American Farm Bureau President William Kufis is with us, as well as Frank Register, the chief of NARGIS, the National Association of Independent Retail Grocers of the United States. Also from the Midwest, University of Chicago economist Yale Brosen is with us to analyze the inflation menace as a whole. We're ready in Chicago.
Thank you, Bill. Perhaps the best way to begin is to refer again to that quote from The Economist, which is a generally cautious publication, and The Economist suggests that we may already be in a depression. President Ford said that he thought otherwise.
Let me say very strongly that the United States is not going to have a depression. The overall economy of the United States is strong. Employment is still high. We do have the problem of inflation. We do have related problems, and we're going to come up with some answers that I hope will solve those problems. We are not going to have a depression. We are going to work to make sure that our economy improves in the months ahead.
Well, that was a question about a depression. Perhaps we're not yet in a depression. Perhaps we're not going to be. That's something we want to go into. But is there anybody who thinks that we are not now in a recession? I don't think we need a technical division. A recession is serious economic difficulties, and a depression, I suppose, is extremely serious economic difficulties. Maybe we can agree on that. Is there anybody who thinks that we are not in a recession? Anybody in New York?
Well, just to follow up on what you said, a recession is the word nowadays for a depression. The president said we weren't going to have a recession, and he wanted to guarantee that. And now the new president is taking a step further and saying we're not going to have a depression, which in effect acknowledges the fact that we're in a recession of some kind. And I've just never heard anybody at any high level talk about the word depression before. It's always been we're not going to have a recession. We're not going to have a repeat of 1929. And a recession has just become the modern-day equivalent of what people used to call a depression. It's just a play on words, semantics.
Going back a little further than that, Ed, it's my memory that the word depression was coined by President Hoover because he thought the word panic was so damaging.
Well, perhaps somebody in Washington wants to say something about this. Peter?
Congressman Pettman?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. We're in a depression now, a deep, bad depression in housing. And that's terrible. We're in a recession in many other industries. But we know we're in a bad depression in housing now. No question about it.
What about Chicago? Let's hear from there.
Rosen, what do you think about this? Well, this is a recession. It's one of the strangest I've ever encountered. We've had steadily rising employment during the past year. Right now, employment is 1.7 million higher than it was a year ago at this time. We broke the 86 million level of employees in June, and we're now up to 86.3 million, a record level of employment.
Do you think you could quite frankly convince the guy on the street of all that, though? Doesn't he really think he's in a recession?
Well, certainly we've had some decline in real wages as a consequence of the fact that we've got to pay $20 billion a year more abroad in goods we have to ship abroad for oil, for example. Also, because of decline in exchange rates, we're paying more for all other imports, and that's a real drain on the produce of the United States and decreases the amount of goods available for consumption here.
Peter Heckes, Congressman Royce.
It's just been said from Chicago that things aren't really so bad, that employment has increased. Well, the fact is that unemployment has increased. A year ago, it was 4.7% of the workforce. Today, it's 5.4%. And hundreds of thousands of people, many of them young people who are coming on the labor market for the first time, are badly missing the pay and the dignity of having a job, and that's creating some of the social tensions in this country.
Mr. Rittenberg.
I could add just one word. Yale Brosen might think employment is rising, but certainly one's got to remember that the labor force is growing and there are more and more people coming into the labor force, and while employment might be going up slightly, the number of people looking for work is going up faster, and therefore, as Congressman Royce has said, unemployment has risen. And we are in a serious recession that may very well turn out to be a very deep depression unless we take some positive affirmative actions rather quickly.
Dr. Renfrey, you have said in connection with housing, and you heard Representative Pattman say that we are in a depression in housing. You have said that all government subsidies should be removed from housing, that the government should get out of housing entirely, and that now about 30% of all houses being built are vacation homes. Do you agree that there is a depression in housing?
Oh, I think there's a depression if you want to say in the construction industry building housing. I don't think there's a depression in the housing available to the American consumer. If you go down in the state of Florida, you go to California, you go to Phoenix, Arizona, you go to Mobile, Alabama, what you find is that the vacation homes cannot be sold. What you're finding is that we estimate one out of three houses in the United States today are being owned as second and third homes. And I didn't know that the housing policy of the United States was ever dedicated to the fact that we wanted people to own two and three homes, number one. Number two is, I think, the situation with regard to mortgages is almost a scandal in the United States. What we are permitting is that we are permitting the people who buy these vacation homes, who own two homes and three homes and take a mortgage, we then permit them to write off two and three mortgage interest charge deductions. I happen to mention this to President Ford, what I thought was one of the needless stimulations of housing in this country, the failure to realize we have vacation homes and conventional homes, and he said, I understand just what you're talking about. I got two mortgages myself. So when you talk about housing in a depression, I think it's an erroneous statistic, and I don't think there's a housing depression in the United States if one is talking about owning the first home as against owning the second or third home.
Mr. Harrington?
Well, I'm delighted to agree with Mr. Renfrey on one thing, but I would, in agreeing with him, challenge something he said earlier. I think due to the enormous subsidy given in the Internal Revenue Code, to homeowners, not to poor people who don't own homes, not to renters, but only to homeowners, and given excessively to rich homeowners, the housing policy of the United States for the last generation has been directed towards subsidizing the rich and nothing for the poor. Secondly, and related to that in your comment, I think we need to stop that subsidy, but put in another subsidy to make it possible for poor people and working people to become homeowners. I think the problem is not that we have subsidies, but that we've had subsidies for the rich rather than for working people and the poor.
Mr. Gaines?
Well, I'd like to back up a little bit on the conversation, if I might, before we leave the impression here that economists and people in related disciplines can't distinguish between a recession and a depression, therefore we can't tell whether what we are now in. I don't know of any textbook that's ever defined a clear distinction between the two, but I think there is one distinction that has characterized all prior periods that have been called depressions, and that has been the incidence of financial collapse along with extreme weakness in the total economy. Now, I don't see any evidence at all at the moment of anything of that character emerging. So, yes, I agree we're in a recession.
Tilford, what would a financial collapse be? In other words, I think it's been a long time since we've had one, and it might help if we knew what you're describing.
Well, many of us are old enough, one way or another, even if only having heard our parents talk about it, of the situation in the early 1930s, where, well, between 1920 and 1933, half the banks in the United States went under when the brokerage industry was decimated. And by the way, this was true around the world. Earlier periods, the 1870s in this country, there was a serious financial collapse based primarily upon the failure of many of the big railroads to be able to float there or to manage their bond issues, their debt. 1890s was a similar period of depression. Now, these are periods of very heavy unemployment, very weak business conditions, but in all cases accompanied by a financial collapse in the sense of major financial institutions going under.
Well, you would agree, wouldn't you, Till, that at least in Wall Street that you're witnessing a financial collapse. You're witnessing the decimation of the brokerage houses in Wall Street, the destruction of values down there, and you're watching one house after another, one house that have been generations in existence after another disappearing into the woodwork, going into bankruptcy, merging. We're destroying Wall Street right now, in my judgment, in this country.
I understand that there's a great desire on the part of some people in Chicago to come in on this. So, Bill Cameron, will you go ahead?
Gentlemen, I think we can all agree that one of the places where the double-digit inflation is extremely obvious is the grocery store, the supermarket. Let's go to our man from the American Farm Bureau, Bill Kufis. Why is the escalation so high for the grocery shopper?
Well, I think we have to realize that the costs of food are relative. The costs of food are higher than they were a few years ago or a short time ago. But the relative costs have to be related to many things. When less than 40 cents out of the consumer dollar goes to the producer, And we have a reduction of 10% in the cost of food. The markets go down 10%. There are a lot of people that assume that they should also witness a similar 10% reduction at the food counter. The other 60 cents out of that dollar goes for very stable costs that have continued to go in just one direction, and they've continued to go up. They haven't gone down. This includes labor, packaging, transportation, interest costs, building costs. All of these things have to be paid by the consumer. And all of these costs have continued to go in one direction, and that's up.
Now, do you think that anyone is getting more than their fair share in that dollar?
Well, you never get a exact fair share. If you could get everyone placed on a level of, say, 100%, you'd have equality, and you couldn't maintain it because you just can't do that politically, and the marketplace has to have more fluctuation in that in order to give direction.
Well, there are two laws of economics I think you ought to take into consideration here when you ask, is everybody getting a fair share or somebody?
Yes.
First law of economics is that any price you pay is too high, and the second law of economics is any price you receive is too low. There's going to be a fundamental tension there.
Frank Register, do you and your Retail Grocer Association feel that someone is getting an unfair share, a lion's share, hog share?
We honestly can't see that it's happening anywhere along the line. We know what we go through at the retail level. We know that our prices continue to go up, not only the price of the merchandise, but all the other costs, labor costs. We feel that the food industry has done a commendable job, beginning with the farmer level up through and including our own retail level, and trying to maintain prices at as reasonable a level as possible in today's very inflated economy.
Well, no one thinks they're getting enough, obviously, these days in inflation. Mr. Kufis,
well,
what do you think the problem is?
I don't think that's true. I think there are people that are getting would recognize that they're getting a fair share at this particular time.
Who are they?
But I think, there are certain segments in agriculture that I know that are being compensated on a pretty good level. But overall, the answer is that they're in trouble. We've had, since the early 30s, we've had farm programs administered politically that have, in effect, guaranteed cheap food to consumers instead of guaranteeing an adequate return to farmers.
Okay, gentlemen, let's go to Peter Hackus now in Washington.
Dr. Alice Rivlin, we heard about the farmer and some of the middlemen and how they fit into this. Who is really feeling the pinch?
Well, the trouble now, I think, Peter, is that we have two conditions, really sick conditions, going on in the economy at the same time, and we don't usually have these two things. We have inflation, prices rising, and a peculiar kind of inflation with food and fuel leading the price rise, and this hits poor people particularly hard. It hits everybody, but the poor spend more of their income on food. At the same time, we have a softness in the economy, unemployment rising, and probably going to rise on to maybe 6.5% unless somebody does something about it. And that hits low-income people, too. So there's a kind of double whammy going on at the moment where the most vulnerable parts of our population are getting hit from both sides.
Ralph Nader, you speak for the consumer.
Well, I think the terms of the discussion here tend to revolve around the criteria established by people who don't question political power in a political economy. And it isn't so much the lack of effective policies in our country. It's the lack of political power for effective policies that might offend the rich and the powerful. For example, in the food area, the discussion is always about prices. Sometimes you get a discussion about concentration of a few large firms which keep prices up in the chains and among food processors and some agribusiness. But very rarely, for example, you discuss value. Now, we know that in the supermarket there's a great deal of what people call waste. Packaging adds, useless packaging adds $10, $15 billion to the food bill. Deceptive merchandising, the kind of foods that have no nutrition whatsoever, convenience snacks, for example. And unless we begin looking into the quality of what is sold and begin squeezing out the waste that has no consumer value whatsoever, we're simply going to accept the economy on producer terms rather than on consumer terms. And, of course, that holds true in the energy area as well. We're told time and time again, my energy specialist, that this country wastes some 40% of its energy, whether it's through the way buildings are built or car engines are designed or what have you. And we're also told that we consume three times more energy per capita than people in France and twice as much per capita than people in England, which aren't underdeveloped countries by any means. And yet the emphasis is not on something that we can do right away, which is curtailing waste, which fights inflation, reduces pollution, and enhances consumer value. So I suggest that in the discussion, if we keep in mind the political power dimensions of what each one of us might want to recommend, we might get down to the realities, which are not only the need for short-term policies, such as perhaps taxing, surcharging people of higher incomes, but also longer-term policies, such as enforcing antitrust laws and promoting competition.
Thank you, Ralph. I think there's an opinion in Chicago. Frank Register?
I'd like to ask Mr. Dater what type of packaging he feels could be effectively eliminated in supermarkets that would reduce some of this waste he's talking about, and consistent with protecting quality of product and the other considerations that we have to work with in a retail store.
Well, for example, many of the packages that meat products and fruits and vegetables come in, actually they promote spoilage. And they also deceive consumers because they can't see what's in the package. You know, the rotten fruits or tomatoes that are packaged needlessly that way. There's also a problem with certain packaging contaminating the food, such as certain kinds of plastics. But I think the Federal Trade Commission and Senator Hart's hearings have shown again and again the amount of wasteful packaging and the amount of price increase that are attributable to this, not just physically, in terms of they're not being needed, but just in terms of camouflaging the properties of the products that consumers would want to know about so they can choose more intelligently, just in choosing meat cuts, for example.
I would like to direct everybody, or anybody who wants to deal with this question, to a single specific question, which has to do with what the government can do and what anybody else can do. And that question is, how do we deal with inflation without causing more unemployment? Who would like to go first? Michael Harrington?
I think that Mr. Greenspan from the Council of Economic Advisors put it quite well, although I don't trust anything that follows his statement. Somebody has got to suffer. There's going to be some pain to deal with this. What I concretely would suggest is that we have to have a shift in tax policy, making those best able to bear the burden suffer. Those are wealthy people and upper-income people. I would prefer to do it by a tax reform, knocking out of the Internal Revenue Code the unconscionable welfare program for the rich, which the Joint Economic Committee estimated 2 years ago at $77 billion per year. I would take those, if we have to do it, maybe just a surcharge. But it has to be a tax program aimed at those who are well off, shifting those funds to an employment-generating public employment program for the unemployed, and defending the gains of the poor in the social program so they're not hurt.
I want to give Congressman Patman and Congressman Royce a chance to answer that if they want to, Mr. Harrington, or comment on it, and then I'd like to come back to Harry Brown in New York. Peter, will you go ahead?
Congressman Patman, that's
yes,
right up your alley.
I would like to mention the housing again as a typical case, because most of us admit that we're in a depression in housing. And I don't think there's any doubt about it. Now, you take, for instance, now, it's funds are not available at reasonable rates of interest for housing construction, residential housing in particular. I think there should be a priority list, and housing should be on that list, and certainly should be at the top.
Congressman
so
Royce?
I think we should give consideration to that.
I think that that it's wicked to have 5 million unemployed men and women in this country as we do today, and say we can't do anything about it. Of course we can do something about it, and public service employment is the least inflationary, the least expensive, and the least energy-consuming way to do it. We have so many tasks that need to be done, from daycare centers to auxiliary policemen and policewomen, to making bicycle trails, to repairing Amtrak passenger track. We've got these unemployed. It's simply inhumane to wring our hands and do nothing about it. I think we should launch immediately on a program with the goal of a job for every American who is able and willing to work, and a first installment on that goal of at least 500,000 public service jobs right now.
Do you have an estimate, Congressman, how much it might cost?
Yes, 500,000 jobs would cost $3.5 billion, all of which could readily be recouped by cutting some of the waste out of the military program, wasteful public works, subsidies to people who don't need them. You have no trouble at all finding that money and putting it to work, giving dignity and a job to the American people, which is what they want.
Ed Newman, when you get to it, we have other people who want to hop in here.
Thank you, Peter. I understand that Professor Brosen in Chicago wants to comment on this.
Well, one of the specific things that government can do is to cut the size of the deficit. A major reason for high interest rates at this point lies in the fact that the federal government's been a heavy drain on the capital markets, and the result has been to greatly reduce the supply of capital and shove interest rates much higher. By cutting about $15 billion out of the federal budget, we could not only reduce that net drain from the capital markets, but we could furnish money to those markets, and that would considerably reduce the interest rates then on mortgages, with the consequence that housing would find funds available that would then raise the level of housing construction.
Frank Register, you were grimacing there as you heard a panelist say that those who can stand it the most ought to suffer the most. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's unrealistic. It's a grand overall objective, but I think the state of our economy and the state of our system of government and our system of checks and balances will not permit that.
Back to Ed Newman in New York.
Thank you, Bill. I want to call on Harry Brown in New York, and then we're going back to Washington.
Well, the original question was how could you solve this thing without high unemployment how or could, with high prices? And I'm sorry to say it can't be done for two reasons, the first of which is obvious, that all of these things are problems now because of people sitting around tables saying, what are we going to do for everybody else? What are we going to do to make things right? And no matter what the solution proposed is, Mr. Nader is going to get a piece of action of the action for his so-called consumers who got their best break when nobody was putting restrictions on their suppliers. Mr. Patman's going to get a piece of the action for the housing constructors who want subsidies to provide so-called low-cost housing. Somebody else is going to get a piece of the action for the farmers and on down the line. And there's not going to be any solution. There never is. And we are going to have that financial collapse next year. But what will happen is the Federal Reserve will run in with billions and billions of dollars of newly printed paper money to shore up all the banks in the country that look important to them. And at the time that that's going on, somebody's going to sit around a table and say, how can we make sure that there's no recession this year? How can we bring inflation under control? And it's going to go on until we have either runaway inflation or that crash. And after the runaway inflation will be the crash anyway. It all comes back to one thing. You as an individual can do a great deal to insulate and protect yourself, but you are never going to solve this problem on the basis that it's presented.
Peter Peterson, former Secretary of Commerce, now wants to say something, and Pierre Rinfrae also wants to say something on this.
We talk about our recession as though the United States is some kind of a island still that's self-sufficient. And yet, having said that, we acknowledge that the price increase in oil and food were the two major contributors to our inflation problem. These were generated essentially by things that happened outside the shores of the United States. I think we are giving too little attention to this whole oil deficit problem, which this year looks like it could hit $70 billion, which is an extraordinary number even in U.S. terms. And one of the ways we're going to have all kinds of bankruptcies in this world is if we do not face how we're going to lend money to these countries that have enormous deficits, what we're going to do about alternative energy sources so we can give the Arabs incentives to lower prices, what we're going to do on conservation programs of energy so that we can reduce this bill. And I would just suggest that looking at this problem both internationally and by sector namely the oil sector and the food sector and some other sectors, may hold some of the answers to what we're going to do about the inflation problem in this country.
Dr. Renfrey?
Well, I, knowing the nature of what Harry Brown's written about, I find it astonishing to myself that I would agree with him so material as I do. And I think he's left out one word. And that's a very old-fashioned word, and I'm sure the politicians would object to it because it is old-time religion. And most people detest, at least I'm told this day, that religion is not a popular subject and old time is less popular. That key word is discipline. We have destroyed all the disciplines in our economic system, and I think the greatest destruction of discipline has occurred in the United States government. I think in the last 5 years, this government has been more responsible for inflation in the world than any government in our history. It lies about its deficits, first of all, or if it doesn't lie intentionally, it certainly lies statistically. We did not have a deficit last year of $3.5 billion in the United States government. We had a deficit of $21 billion because it borrowed an additional $18 billion, which it doesn't show up in the federal accounts, but is borrowing by the agencies. Now, number two, I have great respect for Secretary Peterson. He is an old friend, and I'm a great admirer of his, but I would point out that it is not adequate or fair to say that inflation in the United States is due to oil. Inflation in the United States is due to the most insane agricultural policy, which we began in 1972, of unknowingly, unwittingly, and rather stupidly selling off almost all of our crop reserves to the Russians at prices below world markets, not having full awareness of the Russian and Chinese demand for commodities, and then letting them push those commodity prices through the roofs to where we are now at the lowest food reserve from any time that I can find in the post-war period. So I would merely make one point. We are not going to stop inflation by energy alone or by undoing what the Arabs have done, and neither are we ever going to stop inflation in this country unless this government sets the example of not a balanced budget, but rather a surplus in all of its accounts, both on the record and off the record.
Adam Smith has been uncharacteristically silent immediately to my left, and he's going to say something now.
Yeah, I think there's a very unpleasant air in, there's a kind of rhetoric that comes up now, kind of old-time religion, like what we need is discipline, and what we need is faith, and what we need is honesty and trustworthiness and loyalty and all the rest of it. And nobody ever denied those things. I don't know how far that gets us. I do know that there have been four or five causes behind this inflation, but this is the first time our country has ever been held up by a really serious cartel, which makes Butch Cassidy look like a very small time. And I think the Secretary Peterson is right. If there were some way to drop the energy costs, both by discipline, if you want to use it, or political action, which seems to have been very unsuccessful so far, that not only reduces the price of gasoline, it reduces the price of fertilizer, which in turn reduces the price of growing the crops, and it reduces the baggies that come in, and so on and so on.
Go ahead, Chicago.
Mr. Kufas of the American Farm Bureau, you heard some criticism of agriculture policies dating back to the early parts of this century.
I'd like to make a comment relative to the sale of commodities. Had we not had the agricultural exports last year, we'd have been in a terrible position as far as our dollar balances are concerned. The total picture is dependent upon trade, and we're going to have to trade. We're not self-sufficient. We must use the commodities that we can produce the best and most efficiently so that we can have something to trade just the same as every other country. So I'm one that feels that the sale of grains and the sale of agricultural products to other countries in the world was not a bad deal. It was a good deal. It was a good deal for them, and it was a good deal for us.
Let's go to Washington now, and Peter Hackes.
We have five people seated around this table, fairly bursting. Let's start with Mr. Rutenberg.
Yes, I've been trying to get into the discussion for some time now. It seems as I listen to New York and Chicago, I'm impressed with the fact that this economy is probably so fouled up by the policies of the Nixon and Ford administration, in which Mr. Pierre Renfrey, an advisor to certainly Nixon's administration, if not Ford's, has played his role. the situation is so fouled up that I'm afraid that it might be exceedingly difficult to try to unwind the fouled up problems we find. I think, very honestly and frankly and specifically, that we need to have a very strong and forceful way of handling the kind of problem which has produced higher profits in this country, the very highest profit in the history of the country. At the same time, that wage earners' real purchasing power has been declining. I think we need to tackle that problem simultaneously with reducing interest rates and providing priority for spending in utilities and state and local governments and needed kinds of construction. I would accomplish it through across the board, very strict and very effective controls, not only on wages and prices at this point in time, but upon profits through a kind of a tax increases on profits as well as high-income people. I would also do something about dividends and interest rates, and I would also do something about executive salaries and bonuses.
Edwin Newman, it's yours, but we'd love to come back here when you
can. Okay, thank you, Peter. Pierre Renfrey wants to reply to something that Stanley Rutenberg said specifically about him.
Mr. Rutenberg has got it all wrong on my record. I supported wage and price controls for phases 1 and 2, both publicly and privately, but I parted company on the voluntary program of phase 3, saying it wouldn't work. So let's just get the record straight.
Can there be a financial collapse in the United States? I will repeat the question. Can there be a financial collapse in the United States? And I'd like to call first on Tilford Gaines, who is a senior vice president and economist of Manufacturers Hanover Trust.
For anybody to say that something is absolutely impossible is obviously ridiculous. But I would attach such a small likelihood to it as to say that it's virtually impossible. We've had one fairly major bank in this country run into some difficulties. It has not gone into receivership and will not. If there's another bank that's having the slightest problems, I'm not aware of it, and I don't know of anybody else who is. We've had some real estate investment trusts who found it impossible to continue financing in the commercial paper market. They've fallen back on bank lines. Some mortgage companies, some of the electric utilities have been in the same position. There's a great deal of tension in the financial system, no question about it. But so far as the overall financial structure, and here I'll defer to a remark that Pierre made earlier about the condition of some of the brokerage houses on Wall Street. Yes, they've gone through a very, very difficult period. But I believe that the center of our financial system is the commercial banking system. And it is, so far as anybody can determine, in very sound shape.
Adam Smith?
Let me give you a little bit of a script and see what happens if the script happens. If the inflation doesn't come down, more and more people who have their money in savings and loans are going to find that they can take their money out and get a higher rate elsewhere. Now, the mortgages that these savings and loans have written are all 20 and 30, 15, 10 years. They're still on the books. And if you have a mortgage at a savings and loan, the savings and loan can't come to you and ask you for the mortgage back when people take all their money out. So what happens under that circumstance? The savings and loan has to go to the Federal Home Loan Bank. And the Federal Home Loan Bank, if I'm not mistaken, will bail it out. And how will the Federal Home Loan Bank bail it out? It will take its own paper to the market and float the market, and then you're back into the same cycle again. Now, what you get if this happens is not an immediate financial collapse where everybody looks out the window on a black Thursday afternoon and that's it. Crash. It's a kind of slow motion crash where it looks like an instant replay in a football game where the players all seem to dance their way down onto the floor.
Are you saying that is what is happening now?
I'm saying it's just the beginning of what's happening, and it doesn't have to happen, but it certainly could happen.
Let's go to Washington and Congressman Royce.
Yes, I think there are some dangers of financial collapse, and I think that underscores the need to take some preventive steps now. Just as I don't go around crying havoc and predicting depression, I think it's equally unwise to be a Pollyanna and say that we're in no danger. The fact of the matter is that we have let the curse of bigness descend upon this country. We now don't have the small independent bank anymore. We have huge bank holding company chains. If one goes down, it acts like a domino. We have huge multinational corporations, And they are forever coming around hat in hand to Congress when they get in trouble with their misbegotten misadventures and want to be bailed out on the ground that if one link in the chain breaks, so will all the other links. My point is that with the huge development of interrelated banking systems and multinational industrial corporations, we are in greater financial danger than we ever have been.
So that it can happen here.
It can happen.
Despite all of the regulations and all of the government controls and so forth.
It can
intended
happen.
Intended to prevent that.
And the moral is not to lose our head in panic, but to take preventive steps to shingle the roof before it rains.
Ed?
Ed Newman in New York. We have some disagreement here in New York with what Representative Royce just said from Harry Brown, who agrees that there can be a financial collapse and has said so earlier in the program, as a matter of fact, but thinks it would come about for different reasons from those cited by Representative Royce.
Mr. Brown? He said that it's possible despite the government controls and regulations. I would say it is possible. It is here. It is with us now because of it. I just have to keep coming back to the same thing. You get a bunch of people around the table playing God, deciding who should get a piece of the pie, and then one day, 20 years later, you wake up and you're in the middle of all these crises. Prices are running out of sight. A bank is bailed out by the Federal Reserve, and everybody shouts, Hosanna, see, the Federal Reserve can bail out a bank. If I'm in the investment advice business, if I give in bad investment advice and I'm about to go under, and the federal government comes and bails me out, is everybody going to say, isn't that wonderful what the federal government can do? It can ensure mediocrity.
Well, would you be prepared to see the bank collapse, Mr. Brown, and its depositors?
The bank will collapse
it?
Someday. Yeah. The question is, are 100 other banks going to go under with it because the federal government has felt this God-playing power to keep one bank from going under and flooded the country with paper money, which makes the rest of the banks relatively insolvent. It is the government linking all the banks together that creates the problem. This country is not suffering from free enterprise or competition. This country is suffering from antitrust laws, from price controls. We don't have an energy crisis. We have a government crisis, the government administering energy. We don't have a food crisis. We have a government crisis. The government administers food, and just go down the line. Every problem that you want to talk about comes right back to the government.
Mr. Harrington?
Two things. One, listening to Mr. Brown, I hear a nostalgia for the good old days of Herbert Hoover.
There never was days like that.
No, when we didn't have the government intervening, when we had good old discipline, mainly for working people and poor people, when people had to shape up, we let people collapse, etc. I think it was one of the most disastrous eras in American history. Secondly, in terms of financial collapse, it seems to me that it's possible for speculation and financial skullduggery to have a certain impact on the economy, but we are overlooking in this discussion thus far that the main source of new investment funds in the United States comes from retained profits financing. And the real key to this is not so much what the banks do, it's the kind of gross national product that we produce. And the really dangerous thing now is that our gross national product is slowing down. That's the real seed of a financial collapse. And I would say the financial collapse is going to be a symptom of a much more dangerous recessionary problem, which is why I agree very much with Congressman Royce that we have to have a job program as well as an anti-inflation program, or rather we have to couple our anti-inflation program with a program to put Americans to work increasing that GNP, which I think is for the good not simply of the poor and the workers, but even, if I may say so, of the rich.
I think Ralph Nader has something he wants to say in Washington. Mr. Nader?
The question I think we've got to ask ourselves is, do we have the political leadership and the stamina among consumers and citizens around the country to answer the following issues? Will we install a progressive taxation system so that the wealthy will pay their fair share, which that can then be cycled back into public service employment for the short-term alleviation of the unemployment problem? Will we be able to enforce the antitrust laws to get the proven efficiencies of price competition in the economy and innovation? Will we be able to launch a program of waste prevention in government, for example, and I'm not just referring to three people doing one person's job, but also the corporate welfare budget, like subsidies and loopholes in the tax codes, which do nothing more then decrease the incentive for efficiency and innovation because they can just put their costs onto the public purse. And can we recognize perhaps what Gunnar Myrdal pointed out is the fundamental necessity to permit the consumer to have the kind of power and information to give the consumer interest equitable representation in Washington and in the marketplace?
President Ford was asked not long ago, I think it was at his first news conference, what people could do about inflation, what individuals could do about inflation. And he said his advice was, tighten your belt, as the government is doing. Now, I have two questions arising out of this. Is this an answer? Is this good advice to people? And is there really any similarity between individuals and the government? And I will choose arbitrarily to begin to answer this question, Dr. Alice Rivlin in Washington.
Well, at the present moment, I don't think people are going to have a choice. They're going to have to tighten their belts, whether they want to or not. Our friends in Chicago were advising Washington that the important thing to do was to cut government spending as a cure for inflation. I think that implies that they believe that government spending is the thing that is driving the inflation, and that it means that people are spending too much, the government and other people. I don't think this is really right, and I give you as an example the automobile industry at the moment. Automobile prices are going up very rapidly. It's not because the automobile industry is selling so many automobiles that it simply can't turn them out fast enough. Automobile prices are going up because the automobile industry, like a lot of other industries, wants to cover the rising wages that it has to pay or anticipates, and that it has control over its own prices. It can set them where it wants to and keep its profit margins and its markups up. That's not peculiar to automobiles. It's a circumstance of our whole economy, and it's one that I think we have to face up to for the long term. We need a permanent organization which can look at wage and price increases in advance, see whether they're justified, hold them up if necessary, and expose them to public view. That seems to me much more important and constructive than the suggestion that we cut the government budget, which at the moment, I think, can only hurt, can only increase unemployment, and won't do much for the inflation.
I asked a second question, which is it realistic to tell people, do what the government is doing, pull in your belt? And I think, Pierre Rinfrey, do you want to say something about that?
I will merely say to yourself and to your audience what I've been telling my clients since March of 1973. Don't own any common stocks. Run for the sellers. Go to cash. Hide.
And
Mr. Brown?
Of course, the cliche is that panics cause crashes, when all the history that I've ever read in my life indicates that the panic only comes after the crash. If panics could cause crashes, then we really would be in bad shape, because any loudmouth walking down the street could bring the economy to its knees. And the fact of the matter is that right now the only thing available to an individual, he has no access to Washington, he's not going to change any of this, because all these things are going to be decided by people arguing around tables. The only access that the individual has is to insulate himself from the problems, and he can do this because there are still many alternatives open to him. Some of them are along the lines that Mr. Rinfrey said. Other people are sending money out of the country to put it in stronger currencies that are going to survive this. The Swiss franc is really in good shape right now, having brought inflation under control by the kind of belt tightening that they talk about in Washington, but they only do in Zurich. And a lot of people are just putting their money in other currencies to wait it out, sit on the sidelines, see what happens. They're not going to bring the economy to the knees by their actions. They're simply going to save themselves. And after it's over, then there is going to be some capital available to rebuild and start afresh. But then, of course, just go through the same problems again, because the round tables will meet once more.
Michael Harrington. Everybody talks about government should stop spending so much. It should balance the budget. At whose expense? At the expense of Social Security people, at the expense of Medicare people, Medicaid people, or at the expense of, let us say, those people playing the stock market who are not contributing new money to the economy but simply playing in the crap game on Wall Street, who under capital gains under that procedure, according to the Joint Economic Committee, get about a $12, $13 billion a year subsidy. So I want to conclude whatever I'm saying on this program by saying the crucial question is who's paying, what government cuts, what kind of consumers, what kind of individuals. And I think you have to put in the fact that we live in a society of social classes, and we have to take that into account at every point in the analysis.
This is Edwin Newman in New York. The discussion you've just heard was gleaned from a live two-hour program broadcast over many NBC stations a few weeks ago. Since that time, President Ford has announced a broad 10-point program which he hopes will combat inflation, one we should add that many analysts feel will have little effect. Among Mr. Ford's major proposals, an increase in food production, a reduction of foreign oil imports, and correspondingly a request that the American people individually cut fuel consumption, financial aid to the housing industry in the form of an extension of federal home mortgage guarantees, an increase in the investment tax credit to businesses intended to stimulate industrial growth, an extension of unemployment benefits for those now receiving them, and an expansion of the unemployment insurance program to cover many of those not now covered, a $5 billion cut in federal spending, and, most discussed and most attacked, a 5% tax surcharge on families earning an adjusted gross income of $15,000 a year or more. That, in essence, is the president's program. It would be a brave man, or an unusually foolish one, particularly a non-economist, which I am, who would try to say something definitive at this point. Obviously, we did not go into the discussion you heard expecting unanimity. But perhaps we can agree on this. Just as the American political system was subjected to an unusual test in the past year or two, so the American economic system is likely to be subjected to an extraordinary test in the months to come. How it will come through that test, we simply do not know. We hope, however, that we have shed some light on what is bringing that test about, and shed some light also on the methods being suggested to bring us through it. Edwin Newman, NBC News.